Right, good morning. Are there questions?
I have a question on just one of the computations in here, like how to do it. I was trying to think of how to find those, I think it was question 24. It was, you had a Hurwitz group.
Yeah.
And you wanted to show that PS2L.
Yeah.
Or two.
Oh, yeah.
PSL27
yeah.
was in there, and I wasn't sure how to, because I could find how to get lists of groups of index, but I couldn't, like, extract them or anything.
Okay. What I would do there is simply there is a command which is called gquotient. So you make, let's say, H is your Hurwitz group. Mm. So that's the group generated by A, B, so that A square, A square, B cubed, A, B to the 7. Okay. Mm. And if you now call gquotients for the Hurwitz group, and now you give the group which you want to have as a homomorphic image.
Oh.
So you could simply say PSL27. Okay, that gives you.
Bless you.
Thank you. Mm. All homomorphisms from H onto this group. Mm. The equivalent. sorry. Mm. The equivalence is actually having the same kernel. So basically, if you have automorphisms of the image group, you get different homomorphisms with the same kernel, and these are not listed differently. Anyhow, if you get homomorphisms, you know that PSL27 is a quotient of this group. Right. And the images of A and B tell you what the elements are. Mm. And if it doesn't find any, and it finds them essentially by running through pairs of elements of PSL27 while it runs through up to conjugacy to make it more efficient, and trying, do these images, possible images, fulfill the relations? Mm. And do they generate? And if it doesn't find any, it is not. And if it finds some, yes, it is.
So it's not something that you can really use with just a low index.
What you could do is also, but that is in some way more work. What you also could do, and for that you need to do a little bit more information. So then you need to know in which permutation degree would these groups exist. So what you do, what you would make is, let's say, G would be PSL27. That gets the natural permutation representation on the projective space. You could also take GL and GL modulo the center.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, so, and now you would, if this is a transitive, so you check this is a transitive representation, you check what is the degree. So there is a function. You could, for example, ask for number moved points of G if you don't want to count. And you could test is transitive G on the, anyhow. Or is transitive G on the moved points of G. That gives you the permutation degree. Okay, and now you know if P is a, and you will find that is in degree. Okay, if you construct it that way, you get it in degree 8. That group also happens to have a permutation representation in degree 7. But that's because it happens to be isomorphic to SL32, which is a happenstance. Mm. If numbers are small, weird things are happening. So you would get this on 8 points. So what you could do now is to say, you call low index subgroups of H, and let's say you call index 8, because you found that group has degree 8, permutation degree 8. Of course, if you go have PSL 213, for example, you find this is on 14 points. It's always one, for PSL 2, it's always one more because you have the projective line at an infinity, essentially. That's why there is one more You have your vector space. You look at all the possible lines, and what you do is you make your points. You make your projection line here, and you have, let's say, a distance one or so, and you have all lines intersect there, apart from this line, which is parallel. So you get the cardinality of your field plus one. Okay, that's why it's plus one. And if you have, don't you have PSL 2, but you have PSL 3, you get more. Anyhow, so you collect these in a list, say, and what you now could do is you could ask, what is actually the action on the cosets of these subgroups? So what you could do, let's call it Q for quotient. So I go through this list L, okay. And now this is what I want to do. Is there is a function factor coset action, and I think that gives us a homomorphism. So we want the image of the homomorphism. So X goes to image of factor coset action of my group H on this subgroup, which is called X. So this arrow notation is just a short way to immediately produce a function of one argument. This is just a function of an argument X, which returns the image of factor coset action H, X. Okay. And then you get the groups. The groups which are the actions on the cosets. Well, you could even have inserted here that you only, this gives you up to index 8. You want only those of exactly index 8. So you could say L is filtered of L, and what is your condition? Your condition is that the index of H, X is 8. That will just throw some junk out, which you otherwise get. Yeah. It's still not guaranteed that an action on D of degree 8 gives you this group. So you now would need to check, basically, for these image groups, is any of them a PSL 2.7? So you could say, you could check, do they have the right order? Do they have order 168? And are they simple? Or you could, if you don't know about the groups, that there is only one of order 168 up to isomorphism, you could go and check explicitly, are they isomorphic?
Hmm. Oh, I see.
But that is, so you would test whether isomorphism groups gives you not fail. Hmm. So you could ask for any Q X goes to isomorphism groups of X with G is not fail. And fail, there is a false fail, is in some way a third Boolean, because in certain situations true and false would be plausible answers. And fail is saying something can't be done. So we tend to use this fail for saying, no, what you're asking for cannot be produced. Yeah. I mean, that is testing the isomorphism potentially is a bit more time, more expensive. This runs faster. This is the more efficient way of doing it if you look for a particular group. But that would be the more generic way if you want to see what subgroups are there, what actions. Yeah.
Cool.
And you could have, in this low index, in some way it depends a bit. These groups have permutation representation of relatively small degree, and that's why this works nice. If your permutation representation was of a larger degree somewhere 50 or so, that might take already quite a while. You will get possibly a lot of junk here which you don't want. So if you your image group would be some kind of solvable group, that is probably working better.
I definitely noticed that it took a while for those Lovinix things.
If you try it really, if you make the number bigger, it goes longer and longer and longer. And that's the algorithm. In some way, it is. These two algorithms aren't fundamentally that different. It's just this does it in the essentially by this is faster. This does it in the whole symmetric group, looking for images because it looks for all subgroups, all possible actions. This does it only in PSL27, and that is smaller. You have order 168 versus order 5040. And if your n goes bigger, if your n is 20, then you have put 20 pairs of 20. Yes, okay, it's up to conjugacies, but still you have about 20 factorial search space, and you might just have search space 20,000 or so, or 100,000. That's why this is faster, if you know the group you want. Of course, typically you have no idea what exists as quotient. So that's why you call this. This is in some way just to see, is there anything? Can you tell me anything? And the problem is just, if you have larger solvable quotients, you tend to get a lot of subgroups here. And they are all arising there, so you get a long list and you probably don't want many of them. Yeah?
Could we also do number 25? So I was having trouble finding the subgroup, the derived subgroup.
Okay, so what I would do there is I would define the group, I would call low index subgroups, and what I typically do is I try 10, and I see how quickly does it go through. And if it just comes back after less than a minute, I might try 15 or so. You could already try the result with 10. You want it in some way as big as possible, but you have a finite lifetime. So you need to somehow try your way slowly through these. Okay, and then you get a list like this. Okay, and then I would simply check whether for any L, and then actually what you can just ask for is that you call the abelian invariance for the subgroup. Of this subgroup, and you want to know, does it indicate that it is infinite, and that is indicated by a zero. So if you have a zero in the abelian invariance, because zero indicates a factor which is z. Okay, and for this homework problem, try it with 10, see whether it works. For any, or you could ask instead of for any, you could ask filtered, which would give you not a true false answer, but would you actually give you the subgroup if you want to do something with the subgroup? Okay, because the problem says do that to show that the group is infinite. If it doesn't give you anything, basically it means you need to make your index larger, because there is the promise it works. Okay. In practice, of course, you don't have a promise that it works. And so what you can basically do, the group could even be finite, so you see how much time am I willing to spend on it to try up to some index and do so. And essentially the reason for putting that problem there is just if you're doing stuff into this works, given how naive it is, it works surprisingly well. And it is something, if you come up with a question that you have a finitely presented group and you want to know, is it finite or is it infinite? Yeah. That is in some way a test which requires relatively little intellect to think about, or relatively little mental time to think about. You put it on the computer, you let it run, if you want, let it run overnight, see what do you get. And if it tells you, you find something, you know it's infinite, and you're done. You've proven it.
Right.
And then you can start thinking in more detail if that doesn't work.
So using gap, that's typically how you prove something is infinite. I think I accidentally did size of a group that was infinite just to see what happened. And obviously, it just kept going.
In some cases, it happens to know things from before. Yeah, no, but that's how you would test it. And there deliberately isn't a function is infinite or it is not put into it because it's not guaranteed. And there are some other methods, but there is nothing which is really a generically working algorithm. Yeah. And on the other hand, that is in some way the most typical question people come. Yeah, that's why I mentioned it. What people come up with. I have this presentation. Is the group finite? Or even more often, I have these 50 presentations, which all differ a little bit. Which of the groups are finite? Because someone is classifying certain spaces or so, and he's only interested in those where the group is say, infinite. And then if you have 50 presentations, you want something which goes quickly. That's the reason.
Cool.
Okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? No? So, what we did last time is we proved Weidemeister's theorem, and that basically said the following. If U is a subgroup of a finitely presented group of finite index, then U is isomorphic to a group generated by the Schreier generators, subject to relations which is rewrite expressions of the form Tx are Tx inverse in the Schreier generators. And what are the Tx? These are all coset representatives. These are coset reps, and the R are relators. So you rewrite, take every relator, every coset representative, form all these products, and rewrite them all in the Schreier generators, and that gives you a presentation. Okay. What I want to do is to show you in an example how this works, because that is something which in the end actually is not more difficult. It's much easier than it looks in that way. It's just something which, I mean, this number gets big, right? It's the number of cosets times the number of the relators. You get lots of them. But you also have lots of Schreier generators. So in some way, this is not a very efficient process. You get a lot of generators and you get a lot of relators, which probably will kill a lot of the generators or show that a lot of the generators are redundant. So what you actually do on the computer is you get that presentation and then you run a process which is called Tietze transformations, which are basically heuristic methods for reducing a presentation. If you have a relator in which a generator occurs only once, you can use that relator to eliminate that generator. You can write it in the form, if it is B, C, B, A, B, C, B, C, D, you can is 1, you can so use it to solve for A, because A occurs only once. And then you can use that to throw A out. So that is run afterwards to make it feasible. But that's just a heuristic process. Okay, so let's do an example. And this example is basically the same coset table which we had before. So G was, I think, the group generated by A and B, where I had A squared, B cubed, AB to the 5. Okay, and our subgroup, what was the subgroup generated by A and by A conjugate by B? Okay. Then we had a coset table, and I would expect that this table is now really just copied from what you have before in your notes, We had 6 cosets. Okay, and when I write it down, leave a little bit more space in the columns, because I will write something near it. Okay? So I will have A inverse, B inverse, and I will put something left near the numbers I'm putting. So the coset table was 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 1, 3, 1, 2, 2, 2, 5, 6, 6, 6, 6, 4, and 5, 5, 4, 5. Okay, that was the coset table we got. And if we actually look at how did we get this coset table, there were certain places where we defined cosets. So this was a definition. The coset 2 is defined as 1 times b. So our coset representatives are, the coset representative for coset 1 obviously is the identity, the coset representative for coset 2 is b, the coset representative for coset 3 is b inverse, the coset representative for coset 4, where was 4 defined, 4 was the image of a under 2, so that's a under 2 and a was 1 under b, so that would be BA. Okay? 5 was defined here, so the representative for 5 is BAB, because it's 4 times B and 4 was BA, and T6 is BAB inverse, because that's where we defined 6. We could have made definitions somewhat differently and gotten other coset representatives, but these were the ones we had done. Okay. So, what I now need to do is I need to form Schreier generators. Right? So, I get Schreier generators for every coset representative and every generator. Right? So, for example, I could say I take T1, and that will be my first one, which I will call C. I call them CDE and so forth, just to avoid having S1, S2, S3, to avoid the indices. Okay, so that would be T1 times A. Okay, T1 times A maps me into coset 1, so I need to divide off T1 inverse. And that product, and now I'm evaluating this product, and that happens to be just A, because T1 is 1. Okay? If I take T1 times B, I have happened to hit the coset definition. So I will divide off T2, and I will get the identity. So the if I have T1B, T2 inverse, that is the identity by definition, by the definition of the coset representatives. So that is one which I can leave out. Okay? And you will see it basically that this product would be the identity in the free group. That's how I can see that. If I don't remember how I made the definitions, I would just see this is the identity in the free group. I don't need that. So the next one is for T2. Okay, T2 and A is also a definition. So is T2 and B. Okay, T2 times B is T3, is coset 3, but 3 was defined as 1B inverse. So I need to divide off B inverse. So I need to divide off T3. So I have B times B inverse inverse. And T2 also was B, so I get B cubed here. Okay? Of course, in this group, B cubed is the identity. But it is not in the free group, and that's why I keep it as a Schreier generator. I only drop those which evaluate in the free group as the identity. Okay, then I get T3 and A. T3 maps A, A maps 3 to 3, so I get T3 times A times T3 inverse, which is B inverse AB. I get T3 and B. If I do T3 and B, what do I get there? I think there I get 1 by definition, because I would get T3 would be B inverse times B divided of 1 is the identity. So this is again 1 which is identity in the free group, which is trivial by definition. Because 1 B inverse is T3, then by definition, and some of the inverse definition is also giving me trivial. Okay, so I get T4 and A. If I take T4 and A, I get T2, so I need to divide off T2. And if I evaluate this, I get BAAB inverse. Yeah, that is also the identity in the group G, but not the identity in the free group. G is T4 and B is a definition, so I don't need to do that. I need to take T5 and A as the next one. That gives me T6, so I need to divide off T6. And I get, okay, and that I need to put in the next row because it's too long. That's B, A, B, A, B, A inverse, B inverse. So I have BAB times A, and I divide that off. Okay? And H is T5B, T6 inverse, because B also happens to map 5 to 6, so that will be BAB, B, BA inverse, B inverse. And I get finally one last one, that is T6 and A, and that will be T5 inverse, because A maps 5 to 6, and that happens to be BA, B inverse, AB inverse, A inverse.
Sorry, question. You were talking about T4B. Yes. So it's in between F and G. Was that true? Because I mean, I think because
T4B is a definition. Maybe. That's the definition of coset 5.
Sorry, I meant. I guess I was wrong. I think I meant
T3B. T3B was not a definition, but it is T1, and T1B inverse was the definition. So that's why it also vanishes. I'm just taking the generators, I'm not taking the inverses. We could just calculate. If you want, let's calculate. So we take T3B, T1 inverse, right? Yeah. What is T3? That is B inverse times B, and T1 is the identity times 1 inverse, and that is 1 in the free group, and then therefore, okay?
Yeah, for some reason, when I thought that T1 was A, and I was like...
No. And that is really... I mean, we make this assumption that the representative for the trivial coset is the identity. You don't need this formally. You can do... There is, in some way, nothing special about it. It's just, if you're doing it, this is like lacing your shoes together and walk. You can do so, but it suddenly gets much, much harder than than doing it in the normal way. Okay,
thanks.
Sure. So, and what I'm now doing is these coset representatives, these Schreier generators basically tell me that a coset representative times a generator is not the fixed coset representative, but is just lies in this coset. The difference is the Schreier generator. Okay, so what I have is T1 times A is not T1, but T1 times A is C times T1, because C was the Schreier generator for that multiplication. Okay, so the C basically says, now what I'm writing here in blue, and I'll show it in a more interesting example explicitly, that the coset representative times this generator is a Schreier generator times the coset representative. So I get C here, I get C inverse here. 2, 3, 4 is a definition. Here I get F inverse. Here I get D. I don't get a 1. Why don't I get something here? Because T2 times B
B inverse is 1, but 1 under B is...
Because that is the inverse of this definition. Yeah. Okay. Here I get 3, I get an E and an E inverse. Let's just check with the E, right? T3 times A, I claim, is E times T3. Well, what is E? E is T3, A T3 inverse, yes. So the blue things now make the coset identities to identities on elements multiplying the representatives times generators. And I can fill it in essentially. While I define the Schreier generators, I can define these things. Okay. E inverse, here I get a D inverse, here I get an F, this, why don't I get something here? I think I need to have an... I think here I would need to have an F inverse, I'm not mistaken. 5, 6 is definition, I get G, here I get I inverse, here I get an H. The 4 was, there was one where the Schreier generator was trivial. Here I get an I, here I get a G inverse, and here I get an H inverse. Okay. So I'm just putting the Schreier generators in where I need them. Okay. And now I'm just, okay, now I want to, I've built that coset table, and that is called an augmented coset table. Augmented because I've put some further things in. Right, and now I'm tracing through these relators. And what I need to do in the tracing through is I want to know what Schreier generators do I need. So I collect the blue things, and the black numbers are just the numbers of the coset where I currently am. That's just the state of my tracing process. But at any coset, once I trace through the relator, I must end up with the same coset, because they represent the identity. So I don't need to record what the black numbers are, but I simply need to trace through what happens when tracing these through. Okay. Right. So So now trace every relator at every cosine. So what I get is, again, just a table. If I take coset 1 and I trace through the relator a square, what do I get? A square gives me a C once, and I'm again in 1, and that second A gives me another C. So that gives me C square. Let's trace through B cubed. So 1 under B is 2, and I don't get anything to collect. 2 under B is D, so I have a D. 3 under B is 1, so I've collected a D. Okay? So I get the relator D. Well, if you look at what D is, this was B cubed. That was where I said, well, this is the identity in the group. It's just not in the free group. But I get immediately in the process that this Schreier generator must be the identity. Indeed, one can do some further processing to avoid ever writing down these Schreier generators. One can intermediately eliminate these. But we find this identity, that this is the identity we find also in the process. Okay. Let's trace through AB to the 5. So what do I get there? A gives me C, B, and 1. B gives me 2. Okay, next one. I have C. And I'm at 2. Now A gives me 4, and B gives me 5, and I don't get anything. A gives me G, and I'm at 6. And B gives me 4, so I get G. And I said I'm at 4, right? A gives me F, and B gives me D. And I'm at 3. A gives me E, and B gives me 1. Okay. And this is something which very quickly gets tedious if we do it by hand, but is perfectly, it's doable for doing on a computer. It's just a collecting thing, tracing things through and collecting what you get. So, if we trace through 2 under A, for example, 2 under A is 4, 4 under A is 2, and we collect an F. So we get F here. And again, if you look what F was actually
A squared
B inverse. And since A squared is the identity, this must be the identity. So yes, this is not surprising that you can eliminate this. B2 on B cubed also gives me a D. Basically, if a relator is periodic, as all of them are, I will get the same, or I will get an equivalent result. Because if I trace, if 1 under B, powers of B gives me 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1. So if I start at 2 with B, I get the same thing, just cyclically permuted. So if I would do AB to the 5 on 2, what do I get there? 2 under A is 4, 4 under B is 5, 5 under A is G. Okay, and now my tracing through process is basically in part of the same process as I was before. So I will collect the same Schreier generators, just cyclically permuted. And if I have a relator cyclically permuted, it's just a conjugate of the relator. Okay, so just to avoid boring you to death with this, let me write down what happens with them. Here I get e square, I get the Ginda d because it's a periodic relator. Here I get ECGFD. Four, I get F again. I get H here. Okay, now 4, 5, 6 is the other loop of E. So I will get 3 times H here. Okay, the loop of 1 under AB, under powers of AB, actually, if I look what always happens after 1 pair AB, got me all cosets but coset 6. So for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I just get cyclic permutations of this. So I get here with 4, I get FDECG, and with 5, I get GFDEC. 5 under A gives me GI, 6 under A gives me IG. Okay, and coset 6 under AB is really different, because that wasn't in this loop, and I get here IH to the 5. Okay, right, 6 under A gives me an I, and 5 under B gives me 6 and an H. So I get IH, and I begin at coset 6. So that's how I get the IH to the 5. Okay.
So this is just encapsulating the like normality of the, or that when you quotient, you take all normal ones, because I mean, like you said, what one was it? Mm. F?
Yeah.
F, you know, is 2 under A squared is F, and that's just because that's a conjugacy of the relator A squared, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it has to do with conjugacy. It's the periodicity of the relator.
Okay.
That if I'm tracing through a periodic relator through the cosets, if I go after one step of my first occurrence of the period, if I'm at a different coset, then the process of tracing through the same periodic relator at this other coset will just give me the rest. Right? So if I'm tracing the B cubed gave me a D, this went through 1, 2, 3, and then that collection gave me 1 D. But if I start at 2, it just gives me the D at different steps in the process, and therefore I get the whole thing cyclically permuted. Okay? Right. So, we have found a presentation for this subgroup. So, this subgroup, by the theorem, now tells us this subgroup U is generated by elements C, D, E, F, G, H, I, subject to the relations, okay, C square, D, C, G, F, D, E. What else do I have? I have D, F, E square. Okay, the cyclic permutations don't really contribute something new. That's why I don't copy them down, and I don't copy duplicate relators. It's an FDF E square GI IG. GI IG. H and IH to the 5. Okay, well, now what I could do is I could simplify that presentation. So I can observe D is the identity, so I don't need OD, I even copied exactly twice. F is the identity, so F can also get out. H is the identity, H can get out. Okay, what else can I simplify? I can eliminate I as G inverse. Right? And then this relator vanish. The I becomes a G inverse. Yeah, that was the only occurrence of I. So I have C, E, and G. So I get this would be the same as a group generated by C, E, and G, subject to the relations C square, E square, C, G, E, and G to the minus 5. Okay? Now I can use this relator CGE to eliminate G here, right? That also would be, G would be C inverse E inverse. Because GEC is 1. So I can also eliminate G and I get a group generated by C and E such I have that C square is 1, E square is 1, and EC to the 5 is 1. Okay, and now we can't easily throw out, well, we actually can't throw out any more generator. Okay, do we know what this group is? Well, if you, instead of E, you take the generator EC. So let's say I have another generator, let's call it just, well, let's say J would be EC. Then the group would be generated by C and J, subject to the rules C square and J to the 5. And this is now, so if I do this, E is equal to C inverse J, right? So I would get C inverse J, C inverse J, and that I could write differently as C, let's bring two letters over, I could write this as C inverse J equals to J inverse C, right? Okay, C has order 2, so the C inverse, the inverse I can leave out, right? So CJ is J inverse C. Do we now know what this group is? No, it's not S5.
The dihedral
yes.
105
guy? Yes, it's simply that, right? It's the same kinds of relations as we had with the dihedral group. It's the dihedral group on a 5 gon that has order 10. Okay, so we have a subgroup of order 10 and which had index 6. So we have proven this group G has order 60. Right? And that is actually in principle what GAP does if you ask it, if you give it a finitely presented group and you ask for its size. It's just, it picks a subgroup generated by one generator. Because if your subgroup has one generator, this process, this rewriting process, becomes much, much simplified. Because you can, you know the subgroup is abelian, you can collect a lot of things together. So, yeah. So on the other hand, it is easy to see that A5 is a quotient of this group. So we now have proven this group is A5. Okay. Yes, and again, compare with the K. I just changed the 5 to a 7. And suddenly I have this Hurwitz group, which is infinite. So, yeah, presentations as, if you manipulate this presentation as a string, basically there is very little properties are preserved by such string manipulations. In particular, if your manipulations aren't just rearranging letters, but are changing exponents. You can basically not say anything or very rarely one can say something about the how it changes. Okay. Yeah, so that is an example of this rewriting process, and probably some, people in earlier times did it for bigger indices by hand, but it's something which gets gory quite quickly. Okay, right, questions about this? No? So, then basically, since we have about 2 weeks left, I want to go to the third topic in this class. Yes, it gets a little bit squeezed, but I think we still get to the main interesting results. That's chapter 3, which is extension theory and cohomology. Exact, it's group cohomology because we're looking just at the case of groups. Okay, so what the way I will do it is that we basically first look at a concrete situation in groups, and later on then get to the situation of cohomology. So, what do I want to do? Basically, the generic question in the background is, we have seen already in algebra 1, if we have a group and I have a normal subgroup, I have the normal subgroup and the factor group. I have two. And I can split this apart and get composition factors. The obvious other question is, can I do things and can I put them together? So if I have a normal subgroup and I want to prescribe a factor group, so I take two groups, N and F, can I put them together and get a new group such that N is the normal subgroup and F is the factor group? Okay. And can I do so uniquely, or can I do so, what things can happen? Well, I can always form the direct product. That doesn't require any condition. But clearly not every group is a direct product. Okay, I can form semi-direct products. What I need there is not just the normal subgroup and the factor group, but I need an action of the factor group on the normal subgroup. And there could be different actions. So I could get different, for two groups, I could get two different semi-direct products. But there are groups which are not semi-direct products. For example, if you take the cyclic group of order 4 that has a normal subgroup which is cyclic of order 2 and a factor group which is cyclic of order 2, but there is no what is called a complement, right? What you need for the semi-direct product is not just the normal subgroup, but you need a complementing subgroup, a subgroup which intersects trivially and together generates the whole group. And we don't have this there, because for a cyclic group of order 4, that's the subgroup that is. Okay, so there is more. There are other groups which don't have these properties. Okay, so basically I want to describe, I want to end up with a process where I can have certain, I will probably need some extra information, but something which would allow me to say, I want all groups, my normal subgroups shall be C2, my factor group shall be C2, what are all groups which have such a composition structure? Okay, in this case it's not that exciting, I have C2 cross C2 and C4. But if you pick more complicated groups, more things can happen. Okay. For the first thing, or let me, yeah, but let me start with a definition just so we have the language there. So, if we have a sequence of homomorphisms, and in our case they will be group homomorphisms, but that basically is a more generic definition in algebra, and you can pick whatever homomorphisms you want. So you have some group G, and you have a homomorphism here phi, and a homomorphism H, or let's call it phi 1, phi 2, and probably then I should also call the groups G1, G2, just to G1, G2, G3, phi 3, G4, and so forth, is called exact at the point GI. Okay. If the following holds, if the image of the previous homomorphism, so the image of the homomorphism which goes to GI would be phi I minus 1, is the same as the kernel of the next homomorphism. So that would be the kernel of phi I. If I have that situation, such a sequence is called exact. Typically, one looks at such sequences in the situation that the image will lie in the kernel of the next. So exact, in some way, is the perfect, is things fitting perfectly together. Okay. So a group extension. A group extension is a short exact sequence where I have the trivial group, I map to a group N, I map to a group E, I map to a group G, and I again map to the trivial. Okay. Why short? Well, if you want to have a sequence where you have a trivial object at the start and the end, and you want it to be exact, if you have less than 5 terms in total, everything has to be trivial. That's not hard to check. So if you have 3, you would have identity to something, to identity, yes, then the middle has to be identity. And if you have identity to A, to B, to identity, and you look at the exactness condition, you see very quickly, oh, the two in the middle have to be trivial. So that's the shortest thing one you can actually form with identity at start and end. Where we have, where you can have something more interesting happen. Okay, and that's why it's called a short exact sequence. And what does, how can one interpret this? You can interpret this as that I have, well, if we give names to this, let's call this map mu, let's call this map pi, mu for monomorphism, right? Pi for projection. So, what does exactness at this point mean? This means the image of one, which is a trivial subgroup, is the kernel of mu, right? So mu is an embedding of N in E. Being exact at this point says the image of pi is the kernel of the map to the trivial group. The kernel of the map to the trivial group is everything. So pi is onto, pi is a projection onto. Onto G, and if I now say this, I can basically interpret it in the way that N would be up to isomorphism, or a normal subgroup of E, and E modulo N is isomorphic to G. So that's just some way of describing the situation that I have a group which is put together from two parts N and G. And the question is, if I give you N and G, what possible E's can I put there? Or more generally, what possible sequences can I form? And that's in some way the question of extension theory. Okay. What I typically want is, yes, I have a map from the factor group to the from the factor group G to E. Sorry, from E to the factor group G. What I want is also some way to take elements of the factor group and go back to the group. And I can do so only by picking representatives. So, now we pick a transversal, or if you want, representative map tau from G to E. So, for every element of the factor group, I pick a fixed representative. That's the same as when looking at the coset tables where I picked coset representatives. So I get a map tau which goes from G to E. Tau from G to E. So what I want is that if I apply tau and then pi, that is the identity on the factor group G. So I have a map which is an inverse, but this map tau is a priori just a map. It is not necessarily a homomorphism. It is simply, I mean, this map has a non-trivial kernel. It's a one psi inverse, of course. So if I apply tau and then pi, it's the identity. If I apply pi and then tau, this is not the identity. I will just stay in the same coset, but I will differ by something in N. So if I apply pi and tau, actually, I have a map which will make elements differ by something in N. Okay. So that is the setup we have here. So what would it mean that tau is a homomorphism? So to be a homomorphism, well, if it is a homomorphism, then I have an image, right? Then the image of G under tau is a subgroup of the group E. Okay. And let's give it a name. Let's call it, for the moment, C. For reasons you'll see in a moment. This is a subgroup of E. What can I tell about this subgroup C in relation to the normal subgroup N? Well, if I take N and C, I get the group G, right? Because I have representatives for all the cosets. What can I tell about the intersection of N and C? Well, N was the kernel of pi. But if tau is a homomorphism, then nothing in the and because of this property, the only element in the image of tau in the kernel of pi must be the identity, right? So then N intersect C must be the trivial subgroup. Okay? So what is my situation? I have my group G here. I have a normal subgroup N there. I have a subgroup C there. They intersect trivially, and together they generate the group. That's the situation of a semi-direct product. And vice versa, if I have a semi-direct product, I can choose for, I will have a map from the factor group to C. That's the natural isomorphism here I'm getting from the subdirect product, from the semi-direct product structure. I can choose this as tau, and then tau is a homomorphism, and I have this property. So the answer for this is tau is a homomorphism if and only if, sorry, E, not G, E. E, of course, I call it. So, tau is a homomorphism if and only if E is a semi-direct product of N and the image of G under tau. So the homomorphism property, which is a nice property, corresponds with a nice structure of an extension. And in this case, we say, or some people say, the extension splits, that we actually have two things here which compose the extension. So the extension is split. And some people talk about split extensions, and they just mean exactly the same as semi-direct products. Okay. So, tau can be a homomorphism, but if the group is not a semi-direct product, it cannot be a homomorphism. So we really will need to deal with cases that tau is not a homomorphism. Okay. Right. So, what are the obvious questions? One obvious question is, if I have such a group, can I make tau a homomorphism? If I have a given group, E, can I make tau a homomorphism? And the other question is, of course, yeah, as before, can I classify those E's? In particular, can I classify those E's where tau is not a homomorphism? Right? And even though the second question might be the even more natural one, I will answer the other one first because it's slightly easier. So, question, given E and pi, and therefore also G, can we make tau a homomorphism? Well, so, or in another way, if I have a tau, can I make a tau tilde, which is a homomorphism? Have tau, can we make tau tilde a homomorphism? Okay. And what I will do is, I will also make one assumption. I will make the assumption that N is elementary. Okay, why do I make that assumption? basically because that way things work. So you can try to extend do the things also in the case that n is not. Okay, the elementary is really okay. If n is not abelian, things become far more messy. And they basically become far more messy because if I have an element of n which conjugates on n, things can happen. So there I have, one can try to build and to describe these situations, but it gets far more complicated. But in the case, if it is abelian, it is nice. The elementary is just sugaring on there that I can interpret n as a vector space. So I can describe a few things in linear algebra over fields and don't need to talk about linear algebra over ring integers modulo 7, modulo 27 or something like that, where I have scalars which wouldn't be invertible. That's just to make things easy. If n is solvable, of course, I could consider it to be composed from elementary abelian factors. And that is really, and then such a situation I could do iteratively from this. If n is not abelian or not solvable, then things are far more complicated. But basically what will happen, what happens in the end is, if n, as long as n has a normal subgroup which is solvable, I can do that solvable bit with this theory. So I could assume that n does not have a solvable normal subgroup. In this case, I can look at the socle of n. It must be the direct product of non-abelian simple groups. And as similar as in the case when we have analyzed the Onen-Scott theorem, I must lie in the automorphism group of this socle because there is nothing abelian in the socle. So I must lie in a wreath product of automorphism groups of the simple groups wreath. Well, if I have different types, I need to separate them. But automorphism group of a simple factor of the simple group wreath, a symmetric group which permutes this. So that situation, essentially, we've implicitly already looked at in the own case of Onen-Scott. We've looked at there, the groups we get are subgroups of such a wreath product. So that's very roughly the justification why this is not as restrictive as it might sound. And the other justification is simply this way, in this case, one can describe a nice theory. Okay, and we'll, yeah. So, can we make a homomorphism tau tilde? That's the question. If you come, you give me the group E, you give me some map tau, and that map tau is just, I choose coset representatives. Can I map tau tilde a homomorphism? Can I change tau to make tau tilde a homomorphism? Well, how would tau tilde have to look like? Well, we know that if I have, what would tau tilde have to do with an element G? It would need to map the element G to something in the same coset, right? So this must be G tau times something which is in the normal subgroup, right? Times some element NG, where I have a map from G to N, which maps an element lit G to NG in N. That's how any such map tau tilde would have to look like. Okay. Right, so the question of making tau to a homomorphism tau tilde, I can formulate instead as saying, can I find such a map from G to N, from the factor group to the normal subgroup, that tau tilde defined in this way is a homomorphism. Okay. So far I'm basically, this looks as if I'm going around the problems, if I'm just introducing new things and I'm not solving it. But basically, the NG, essentially, I would have to look at G tau tilde divided G tau. And to avoid writing the quotients, I'm introducing that as another measure. That's the right measure to look at. Okay. Well, what does this mean? When is theta tau tilde a homomorphism? Well, it is a homomorphism if the elements G tau tilde fulfill a presentation for the group. Well, or initially, let's just look at the product. Let's probably first look at arbitrary products. If G times H is equal to K in the group G, I want that G tau tilde times H under tau tilde is K under tau tilde. That's the homomorphism property. Okay, so what does this mean in the context of this element, of these elements in G? This means that G under tau times NG times H under tau times NH is K under tau times NK, or if I want to say K is GH, I could say this is the product GH under tau times N for the product G times H. Okay? So, what can I do with this? I can change the left-hand side a little bit. And I can chain, basically, I want to collect the tau parts and the n parts separately. So I want to write this as g tau, okay? This I want to move past there, the lame trick of group theory, insert an identity, which is written as an element times its inverse. So I put here an h tau and an h tau inverse, so I get ng conjugated by h tau times nh. Okay.
So you're looking at the image of h under tau. That's tau, not tau inverse, right?
Not tau tilde.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's tau. And the reason I'm doing this is that I'm saying, initially, say you give me this group E. Basically, you give me some way, some version of tau. You just choose representatives for the cosets. How can I make this? What condition, how can I make these NG to be, to get a tau tilde, which is a homomorphism? Okay. So, what do I have here? Here I now have this conjugate. And this is the first place where I'm using that N is abelian. Okay. If N is abelian, this conjugate only depends on H. It does not depend on the choice of tau. If N is abelian, this does not depend on the choice of tau. And that is really useful. Because I now have So what I actually have is I have a further data point or a further thing which I need to describe. I have an action of the factor group on the normal subgroup. That's the same basically as in the case of a semi-direct product. There I needed to prescribe an action of the complement on the normal subgroup. It's just I don't necessarily have a complement, I just have a factor group. So what I have is, so we have further input. Input action of G on N. And this action actually has to be a linear action because we want these to be group homomorphisms. And if I look as N is a vector space, the vector space structure is basically the group structure. So action, this action is linear. Okay. Right. So what I can do is I can solve, I can bring the NGH on one side and I can bring the other things on one side. So what I get is that NG acted on by H times NH. I divide from the right with NGH. Is the same, and I divide from the left with G tau inverse and H tau inverse. H tau inverse G tau inverse GH tau. Okay. What have I now gained? And what on earth with this bit here, which looks so horrible? Well, if you're in the situation that you want to find out whether a concrete group E is can be written as a semi-direct product, you have chosen your tau, you can evaluate this. This is some element in N. And what are these? If you consider these values ng as variables, these are linear equations. These are elements of a vector space you want to find out. You're acting linearly on the vector space, and then this becomes addition and subtraction. This is an inhomogeneous linear equation. Okay. So, if I would do this for all products, I could write down all these linear equations, and if they have a solution, the solution will give me a complement. If I don't have a solution, I don't have a complement. In practice, one can do this slightly easier. Namely, I would pick generators for my group G. Then what identities do I need? Then I basically just need to look at products which are relators for G in a presentation, because any map on generators which fulfills the relators is a homomorphism. So then I do something like this. It's just the relators are not just products of two, it's products of more. So I get somewhat more complicated expressions. But they're still inhomogeneous linear equations. I calculate that set of linear equations and I try to find a solution. And if I find a solution, I have found a complement. And that is the function, for example, in GAP, which calculates complements. There is a GAP function which is called complement classes. And this has a small c here for some historic reasons, which would get the group E and the group N, and it will return you a list of subgroups, maybe empty. These are the possible complements up to conjugacy. And what it does is exactly, it calculates a presentation for the factor group E modulo N in some generators, and it builds these equations here, and it solves the equations. And yeah, then there's a little bit extra for the conjugation, but that's what describes that what finds these complements. Okay, so in some way the question to find out in a concrete case whether we have a complement, we can solve this way. You don't want to solve this by hand again. This gets messy. But at least in principle we can solve it. But where I want to go here is actually not towards solving it in concrete cases, but I want to go towards trying to describe more of a structure. Can I, what is this? Do I have some kind of structure here? Okay. So, what I will therefore do, and at this point, it is at this point it will not be clear what does this have to do with describing all possible ways of putting things together. Basically, it turns out that even though this is in some way just describing complements, we can describe this as, I said, it's a system of linear equations. It's a linear map. The kernel of the linear map in some way describes whether the extension is split. The image of the linear map will tell us something about possible ways to put groups together. And that's what this term cohomology means. So where we are basically going to, here we have maps from G to N. And N is not just a group, but is a group on which G acts. We will also look at maps from zero copies of G to N. These are elements of N. We will look at maps from G cross G to N, and G cross G cross G to N. And between these sets of maps, we will have these sets of maps are we will call co-chains. And between these sets of maps, we have other homomorphisms, co-boundary operators. And that is basically one of these co-boundary operators. And that will give us the cohomology. And the first cohomology group, which has something to do with this, describes complements. The second cohomology group will describe ways how one can put groups together. So that's the goal where I'm aiming for. And yes, initially there are a few things as here where it seems we are defining maps, and just later we see how they fit together. And essentially now from this situation, the tau tilde we don't really need anymore. We've in some way solved that problem. What I will do next is to look at the situation to say, this is inhomogeneous. Let's rather look at the homogeneous case. What happens there? When are complements conjugate? And then we will slowly build up this structure. And all of these co-chains and boundary homomorphisms will basically come at the very end that one will say, okay, here is the general framework in which these things will be. Okay, thank you very much, and I'll see you on Monday. Monday, Tuesday. I play Monday. Because normally it's Tuesday.
Yeah. I see us on Monday too.
Yeah.